get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network. Okay, today we're going to have a special Labor Day show. Those of you who have been listening to our show over the past year, I'm sure recall that we've had a number of periodic shows dedicated to the subject of, quote, is union labor at a strategic impasse in the U.S.? And I've had a number of guests on different shows talking about that subject. Well, I've invited four of them back here today for a roundtable discussion on that same subject, is union labor at strategic impasse and what to do about it, in this special Labor Day roundtable interview. Okay, in previous shows, we've discussed in the course of the shows the question of the dimensions of the problem. And we focused on strategy in three specific areas. One, union organizing, membership strategy, bargaining strategy, and political strategy. Without going into detail again on this question of the dimensions of the problem, let me just briefly recap, because I want my guests to talk about, well, what do we do about it? Instead of just talking about the dimensions. But, let's just briefly recap. I'll recap some of the main points about the dimensions of this strategic impasse in these three areas, organizing, bargaining, and politics. Membership, organizing. Okay, today in the private sector, unions are less than 7% of the labor force. 30 years ago, they were 22%, and in certain major industries, well over 50%. So we've had a collapse in membership. A lot of this has to do with employer opposition, but, is labor partly at fault here for not organizing the unorganized? We know the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, is a dead-end approach, and we know politicians now won't touch card check solutions to the membership collapse. We know unions, some of them, have turned to organizing the employer, the company, instead of organizing the workers. And we have some questionable AFL-CIO new definitions of membership that have been created in recent years. I'm sure my guests will talk about that. If we had the same number of people in unions organized today that we had in 1980, we would have 35 million members instead of the 15 or less million that we now have. You can just imagine what kind of bargaining and political clout labor would have. So, at the root of the problem is the collapse of membership, not all of which is attributable to failure strategies on the part of labor. But is it partly responsible? And if so, what do we do about it? Second, the bargaining strategy appears at a dead end. For years now, there's been concession bargaining, which has spread and deepened, not just wages, but benefits, and oftentimes overlooked expansion of management rights and decline of union and membership rights. And, of course, the second major element of bargaining strategy has been what's called maintenance of benefits, giving up wages in order to keep your health care and pensions. Okay, so today we see a collapse of that going on after decades of diverting wages to maintain benefits on the pension side. 401ks continue to grow, cash balance plans allow companies to break up defined benefit pensions, right? 20% transfer of funds from pensions to maintain health care benefits. We've seen the allowing in the 2006 pension reform bill to allow companies to engage with hedge funds and speculate, and of course that has meant a collapse of pension funds. And now we see new initiatives allowing companies to sell off their pensions for annuities, and now latest development laws allowing people to cash out their pension plans. Pension cash-outs, latest development. And on the healthcare side, we see Obama's Affordable Care Act now, which will mean most union-negotiated pension plans by 2018 will have to pay a 40% tax, which won't happen. And in politics, of course, over $400 million spent by labor in two rounds of election 2008-2012 with little to show for it. Okay, enough for the dimensions problem. Let's move on and talk about what's the solution. The focus today on what my guest to address is, what do we do about it? What do we do about organizing? What do we do about bargaining? What do we do about politics? What new directions of strategy are perhaps necessary? Now, each of my guests here are veterans. All of them have had more than three, sometimes four decades of experience in the union movement as activists at various levels, mid-levels and local union levels and rank-and-file levels here. And I'd like to welcome them all. We've got Steve Early, who is a former CWA staff representative. We have Greg Shotwell, who was a national rank-and-file leader in the United Auto Workers. Jerry Gordon, who was a representative for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union and various other roles, and Chris Rivera, who is a secretary-treasurer of Teamsters Local 808 in New York. Okay, gentlemen, thanks for coming on. Let's jump right into it. In the first half of the show, let's sort of just state our ideas, your ideas, on how we address these three areas, thinking out of the box if necessary, sometimes way out if necessary, because obviously the thinking and the ideas that have been bouncing around the last decade as the crisis has deteriorated have not really addressed the problem very well. What does labor need to do to turn around the decline in membership? What does labor need to do to get out of this dead end of concession bargaining and maintenance of benefit bargaining? What does labor need to do to get some political results from all the money it's throwing at politicians? Steve, I know you've been writing about this in great detail. Steve Early, by the way, has a new book out that people should take a look at called Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress by Monthly Review Press. So, Steve, since you've been obviously thinking and writing about this in some detail, why don't you jump out here and take 5 minutes and whatever, tell us your views of what needs to be done to turn around this organizing and membership decline, but as well bargaining decline and politics decline.
Well, thanks, Jack. I think the two topics are related. I'll just try to keep it very brief, just touching on the organizing challenge and maybe how that relates to politics. The biggest source of the declining membership that you just cited lately has, in many parts of the country, been within established union bargaining units, which is a new variation on a longstanding threat. As we've seen, as a result of some unfavorable court decisions and several Midwestern states, including most prominently Indiana and Michigan, introducing anti-union legislation, we now have a situation where many unions throughout the U.S., in both the private and public sector, can no longer count on employers to collect dues for them. Membership in unions is now becoming much more voluntary in many, many places. Unions, particularly those representing home care workers, now are going to be restricted in their ability to collect agency fees, the alternative to membership dues that is an option for workers in many union-represented workplaces. All of this adds up to a very big, what you might call internal organizing challenge. External organizing is something that I and others on the call have worked on for many years. It involves recruiting non-union workers, getting them into new union bargaining units, negotiating contracts to cover them. But now we face an internal challenge because unless unions change the way they function very radically and very quickly in many workplaces where they have bargaining rights to some degree, once these become open shops, which is the trend at the moment as a result of successful corporate-backed right-to-work campaigns, unions are going to have to really be much more responsive to their members. They're going to have to develop ways of collecting dues other than check-off automatic deductions from workers' paychecks, something that requires legal backing and the approval of employers. And this new model of union functioning as voluntary membership dues-paying organizations, much more focused on the workplace, much more engaged in direct action, is not really new. It's old. It predates the 1935 National Labor Relations Act. This is the way unions functioned in the pre-Wagner Act era, and more of them are being forced to function today. So I think that really this Labor Day is one of the most serious challenges facing unions that want to even just maintain their existing membership, much less grow in the years to come.
Well, I think you make a couple of very important points here, and that is, in what you've said, you've indirectly described the connection between politics and organizing and membership decline. Obviously, all of these three areas are not mutually exclusive from each other. They all impact each other, and reference to the open shop initiatives and successes that have been occurring, I mean, that's clearly a political problem. At state level and national level, you know, your focus on internal organizing versus external is I think, an important focus here. But you say unless unions change the way they function, and you gave a couple examples. Can you elaborate on that, Steve? Function. How do we need to change the way we function? You talked about dues collection and direct action. What do you mean by that?
Well, in a difficult situation like public employees now face in, say, Wisconsin, in the period since the legislature and the Republican governor there stripped unions of their ability to collect dues through payroll checkoff, greatly narrowed the scope of public sector collective bargaining in a state that had one of the strongest government employee bargaining laws for the last 30 or 40 years. In Wisconsin, to avoid plummeting membership, unions, whether they're the teachers or the state, county, municipal employees or the Education Association, have all had to try to rebuild their workplace structures, try to create stronger steward networks, try to organize members around workplace issues. When you don't have the type of collective bargaining agreements that those unions had before in the public sector in Wisconsin, the union's representational role is very different. For better or worse, depending on your point of view, there's less for lawyers and lobbyists and full-time staff to do and a whole hell of a lot more for members to do. If you don't have mobilized, educated, activated members in that kind of quasi-open shop situation, you're going to have precipitous decline in dues-paying membership. You're not even going to have a mechanism for workers to go around and sign up their coworkers to continue to pledge financial support for their union. So I think the Wisconsin situation is really a great case study in the challenges that labor organizations are facing, unfortunately, in more states.
So what does do workers need to consider doing different in this new world of the growing open shop?
Well, where the past ability to negotiate over a wide range of workplace issues and reach a kind of signed collective bargaining agreement has been abolished or greatly circumscribed, as is the case in the public sector in Wisconsin, the only way that workers are going to be able to protect themselves from unfair discipline, from changes in personnel practices that adversely affect them, the only way they can pressure government agencies for better treatment is through collective action. Shop floor struggle of members sticking up for themselves and confronting management. And where unions in Wisconsin and elsewhere in this new environment have been able to go back to the basics of that kind of union functioning, they've been able to maintain a presence, and but it's tough because when you've spent 30 or 40 or 50 decades functioning more as an insurance company, relying too heavily on full-time staff and formal collective bargaining agreements and employer recognition and automatic dues checkoff, those legal props can, in institutional arrangements, lead to a certain laziness about how the union organization functions, how it relates to its members, and there's got to be some behavioral change very quickly for the organization to survive in that setting.
So you seem to be arguing that return to the future or back to the future, that we should go back to pre-1935 forms of local and shop floor organization and activities. Is that the main thrust of
what you're saying? Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make too much of a virtue out of necessity. It's necessary whether we like it or not. I mean, there are some people on the left have long criticized dues checkoff and exclusive representation, reliance on the employer to collect dues and collective bargaining agreements that include no strike clauses. Well, a lot of that is being wiped out, so we don't have them to kick around anymore. But workers are back in some cases to where they were before 1935 in terms of their workplace legal rights, which in my view is not a positive development, but they can, I think, draw on some of the historical lessons of how unions were created, how they functioned, how they in some cases thrived prior to the National Labor Relations Act being enacted as one model for the future.
Okay, let's hold that. Whether the way to the future is back to the past and back to the future. Greg Shotwell, UAW, I know you've been very active and have very distinct views on this question of organizing at the shop floor level, where you've spent decades doing just the same. Jump right in, Greg, and tell us what your view is on this question of internal membership decline, which seems to be the focus of the big membership collapse. External organizing, of course, and membership growth has been pretty weak, but the decline has been internal, as Chris focuses and identifies. What are your views on how the organizing strategy has to change? And maybe you can talk about that in relationship to UAW's recent attempts to organize in the South.
Yes. There's not a short-term solution to organizing because the struggle never ends. The closed shop and automatic dues deduction isn't solidarity heaven. History revealed that it wasn't a honeymoon, it was the beginning of a divorce proceedings. Divorce, that is, from the rank and file. When the company collects the dues and pays the negotiators, workers are left out like latchkey kids. They can get in the door, but there's nobody there. They don't have that direct interaction that's so fundamental. The fundamental building block of unionism isn't the union office, it's the work group. It's the gang mounting axles or walking the iron. A good example of this is, I think, last spring the UAW lost an organizing drive at Volkswagen in Tennessee that was endorsed by the company. Now, the election was close, but it reveals how much the policy of company-union partnership has weakened the UAW's reputation. Even when the company wanted the union, the workers didn't see it as an advantage. Now, as a result, the UAW came back with a tactic that predates the National Labor Relations Act. They have started a members-only union. Now, as a person who believes in solidarity unionism, who believes that workers' rights are defined by struggle, not law or contract, I'm excited by this prospect. But what excites me isn't the UAW bureaucracy. What excites me is the response of workers on the shop floor. Labor Notes reported that workers have seized the opportunity to join the members-only union and raise the bet. They raised the bet by starting a petition. They're collecting signatures on this petition, which demands that Volkswagen make all temporary workers permanent. Now, this demand exceeds the predominating UAW contracts, and it defies the UAW's commitment to Volkswagen in their neutrality agreement to maintain the company's competitive edge. This was not the UAW's idea of organizing. But based on how close that election was last spring, including temps in this new members-only union, guarantees a majority. And workers, to me, when workers seize control of their organizing drive, that's the most exciting development in the labor movement, because it's based on solidarity, not phony neutrality agreements. Of course, when it comes to, you know, you talk about bargaining, you can't divorce, I don't think, we should divorce, let me put it that way, bargaining from organizing. And again, I'm going back to solidarity unionism. When the UAW agreed to two-tier, they shot themselves in the head, not the foot, the head. They claimed that they survived to fight another day, but they could get a raise year after year after year and never gain back what they gave up, not just in money, but in solidarity.
If I could jump in and make a comment on the UAW and this situation in the South and this neutrality agreements, which have been an expression in recent years of organizing the employer rather than the workers. You know, from what I understand, and correct me, Greg, because I know you're up on this picture there, the UAW has agreed to the concept, at least with Volkswagen, of a works council. In other words, let the workers form their own quasi-de facto union, the work council, and then the UAW will be a union over on above. It's a kind of creating, going again historically back to the 1920s, when we had this practice of non-exclusive representation. In other words, employers created works councils in the 1920s as a way of keeping unions out. They were even called the Rockefeller Plan. One of the big demands of unions by the 1930s was that, look, it's got to be exclusive representation, one union. But it seems to me like this works council thing is a way of bifurcating a union in the company on the shop floor. Now, I know there's some positive arguments you can make about work councils, but this as a way of a members-only union, as they say, it looks to me like another experiment that actually weakens union membership and union solidarity. I don't know. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I agree with you. You know, the idea of the works council, that's the German version of what we have in the United States, or what the UAW has called partnership with the company, or joint programs. And that's where they have appointed UAW people and company people working side by side in their offices together to manage the workers. Now, some good things may come of this. The UAW does have better safety and ergonomic programs in their organized shops than in the unorganized shops. But when the union is partners with the company, it undermines solidarity. It undermines the fundamental building block of the union, which is the work group. Now that the union moves off the shop floor and into the back rooms, it moves into the offices. So the workers themselves don't see the union as their advocate. They don't see it as their own. This not only disrupts organizing, but I think it undermines bargaining. And I'm not just saying this as an opinion. We have to look at facts. When the UAW began this partnership, that was the beginning of the decline, or the beginning of concession bargaining. And that has ultimately led to two-tier. And, you know, in the 2007 contracts, the UAW decimated Solidarity. They chopped up the union to so many different tiers and groups and competing groups that Solidarity was effectively internally destroyed. Let alone
so. External. So, if the old form of shop level organization doesn't seem to have worked, perhaps because it was broken up, as you say, and the Works Council, you know, that's another question. What do you see as the form of what new needs to be done? If Works Council is not the answer, if you know the old way, which has been destroyed, is no longer the answer, what's the answer?
Well. Like I say, what excites me is what I'm seeing workers do in a right-to-work state. In fact, recently, a members-only union in North Carolina, and this is in the latest issue of Labor Notes, won an 80-cent raise for all the workers. So this can be done. But what I've seen that these VW, these Volkswagen workers are doing in Tennessee is broadening the pool of workers that they choose to represent, to advocate for, by including the temp workers. And this petition is gaining momentum because they're going worker to worker. This isn't some outsider. It's not a union organizer. It's the guy working next to you on the line says, look at this. My brother, my neighbor, my cousin, your buddy, they're temp workers. They're making half as much money. They got no benefits. They're taking advantage of them. Let's make them whole. Now, that's solidarity. I believe that that is what's going to result in better organizing because the workers themselves own the union. Also, I think it could lead to better bargaining.
Greg, you have any comments on the question of bargaining strategy? You know, this maintenance of benefits approach here. I mean, in the UAW, it's perhaps most glaring obvious here when just a few years back the VEBAs, you know, the voluntary employee benefit plans where the auto companies dumped their negotiating a health care onto the union to do whatever it could do to maintain benefits, clearly a dead end. And of course, pensions, we see these new trends in pensions that are coming, shifting, selling off the pensions to annuities, which the courts have legally just agreed to, and letting people buy out their pensions like they buy out 401ks is coming now. What do you have? What's the answer to concession bargaining and maintenance of benefit bargaining, which is, you know, the best of the worst of bargaining strategies in the last 20 years?
Again, there's not a short-term solution. We have to look, I believe, long-term, and we have to include in bargaining as a goal solidarity unionism. In other words, all workers have to be treated equal, and we want to extend that bargaining pool, and there's no reason why we can't. In bargaining, say, we want all temps made permanent. We want all second-tier workers to have equal pay. Or we want, in this bargaining, to make these contract workers part of our union. We need to broaden that. That gives us more bargaining power. The VEBA was a good example of a short-term solution, but it's not going to work. Well, first of all, it's going to run out of money. And it's like with Obamacare, again, rather than settle for this patchwork program, if the unions had all got behind single payer and said, we're not going to bargain just for our members, we want to bargain for all the workers in the United States. We think all workers should have this single payer health care system, and thereby that wouldn't even be on the bargaining table. Our members wouldn't have to be trading wages for benefits, and our employers would have a better competitive advantage. No, well, not advantage, but it'd be equality with all the other major industrial nations, because they have their own national health care.
Well, you seem to be suggesting that the past idea of bargaining limited to the bargaining unit and the company, and even within the company, just a bargaining unit within the company, may be the strategic problem. And your point suggests that maybe politics, political bargaining in some shape or form, not just lobbying, I don't mean lobbying necessarily, but some kind of political bargaining on a broader scale beyond the confines, the very controllable confines of the smokestack bargaining units that we've established, might be the answer. Okay, so let's move on here. I want to give Jerry Gordon an opportunity to talk. Jerry, either about organizing or bargaining strategy or political strategy, what needs to be done to solve the problem?
Jack, thanks for having me on the program. Today I read Steve Early's article, Open Shop Trend Makes Organizing the Unorganized Top Union Priority. Found it very valuable information and some great insights and analysis, and Greg has just added to them. So I defer to both of them on those subjects because I want to deal with some other aspects of what constitutes labor's crisis and stagnation. And I've got four subjects, headings on this matter. One is building social justice unions as opposed to business unionism. The second is labor community coalitions. The third is solidarity. And the fourth is independent labor political action. On social justice unionism versus business unionism, Greg is 100% right in emphasizing the value of single-payer health care. It's not only the benefits for the workers, which he's described, but there's other aspects to it. In terms of the union's ability to make sure that everybody is covered regardless of employment. So, and it's also very helpful in the bargaining front, because if you strike or there's a lockout or work stoppage under many union situations, the employer threatens to terminate health care plans, and so the workers settle for less. With single-payer, healthcare never ends. That threat cannot be held over workers' heads, and it's taken off the bargaining table. In a broader sense, labor needs to move out on these other social issues, this issue particularly, and it can, through actions, solidarity actions, mobilizing, and bringing to the forefront the needs of all workers, irrespective of union membership, and win the respect and gain the support from those workers not in unions by defending not only its own, but by leading the fight for health care for all. This whole thought of social justice unionism extends on many fronts: education, civil rights, civil liberties, climate control. Labor has to provide leadership. It's got the forces, despite the drastic loss of members, it's still the most potent social movement in this country, and given enough pressure, particularly from rank and file, even these misleaders can be compelled to offer some resistance and embrace positive goals. Now, as we know, at the LA convention last year, and 5 years before in Pittsburgh, the AFL-CIO unanimously endorsed single-payer health care. But what have they done about it? I mean, we need more than paper resolutions. We need people to be out in the streets. We need a national march on Washington led by labor with all of its allies. Think what that would mean in terms of organizing. If workers on the outside of unions see unions performing this kind of role that will benefit them, that'll make organizing much easier. And that is a segue into the second point, labor community coalitions.
Jerry, before you move into that, if I can just summarize, are you saying then that the solution to the membership decline and the bargaining impasse is social political action? That's what should take precedence in terms of strategy, and that organizing and bargaining would improve as a consequence? Is that your view?
Well, I think it would improve as a consequence, but I don't want to pit one strategy, one focus against another. Everything that Greg and Steve have addressed are extremely critical. This is complementary to that, and
okay.
I think it would be a big boost for organizing if the union got the status, the prestige, the respect, just not only of the working class population, but the middle sections of the country, and it would establish itself as the foremost champion of the welfare of all workers for a better life, all people.
Mm-hmm.
Other than the 1%. And I'm saying that there's these other issues like education, civil rights, civil liberties, and climate control where the same thing obtains. So as I start to say, this is a segue to labor community coalitions. We can't go it alone. We're 7% of the workforce is organized, Jack, as you point out. And we need to strengthen and underscore the alliance with community groups. Now, I know this was stressed at the AFL-CIO's convention, but it's not enough to come up with a program. You've got to implement the program. We have to have a fighting, militant leadership that believes in taking robust actions out in the streets. When is the last time that labor has called a march on Washington? I'm going to get to that in a minute. But anyway, coalition is a two-way street. When we have our problems, our strikes, our struggles, we need to reach out to the community and involve them, educate them, explain to them why our struggle in the union movement against the corporation is in the interests of the broader community. And that means that we've got to address their issues as well as project our own. It's a two-way street. With regard to Volkswagen, it was reported, probably Steve would know more about this, but the reports I got was that a community coalition did form and did approach the UAW leadership and offered to help mobilize sentiment on the outside. And we know what the right politicians were doing, denouncing and all the other right-wing forces, and that they got a cold shoulder. But if that is the case, and that's what was reported, it's an example of a breakdown and a huge tactical mistake. On solidarity, Greg has stressed solidarity within the workforce. Absolutely essential. There's other solidarity, and that is if we don't support our brothers and sisters in their struggles with other employers, that's going to spell the death knell for the unions. Let's go back to 1981 when Reagan fired 12,000 air traffic controllers who had hit the bricks 2 days earlier. I mean, their demands were mainstream, wage increases, safer working conditions, 32-hour week, and so on. So when Reagan fired them, the AFL-CIO issued a statement opposing it, but let's never forget, the top leadership of the AFL-CIO wrote to their affiliates discouraging solidarity, discouraging strike actions. And so government busted the union, a federal government busted the union, open union busting, and it was passively accepted. And then a month later, there was the Solidarity Day demonstration in D.C., as you will recall, and support for the air traffic controllers were not part of the official program. The country should have been shut down. And in the aftermath, wherever you'd go, I traveled around, listened to many union leaders, they said, we should have shut the country down. Too little, too late. It was a pivotal battle. It was a showdown battle. And it has a historical significance adverse that stays with us to this day. Which leads me to the last point, which is independent labor political action.
Before you jump into that, Jerry, let me ask a question here. If you're suggesting more labor community coalitions and joint actions, what form would these joint actions take? I mean, if the national union leadership won't go there, as you pointed out, you know, they just talk the talk, resolutions, and when it comes to taking a real step, like at last year's convention, they backed off of that. Is it just ad hoc union community group actions which have occurred from time to time, but then dissipate, don't go anywhere? How could local unions themselves organize something more structured and durable in terms of labor community actions when the national union leadership is not interested in that? I mean, it seems to me this has to come from below if it's going to happen. What form would it take other than just ad hoc? You know, we have a problem, come join us. Community groups have a problem, ask labor to come join them. And, you know, you get a little cooperation, and then the whole thing disappears again.
Well, you're right, Jack. It's much harder when the top union leaders either don't programmatically agree or they do and don't do anything. I once had a brief conversation with Richard Trumka. He was in Cleveland. And I said, why don't you mobilize against these threatened cuts? He says, we're against the cuts. He dodged the question. And so we have formed a coalition in Cleveland, a no-cuts coalition. And it's small, but it's a beginning. It's against cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And the head of the AFL-CIO in Cleveland is one of the two co-coordinators, along with a community leader, the head of the American Friends Service Committee. And we attract a number of people, a number of community groups. So, yeah, you need these ad hoc coalitions. There's Jobs with Justice, which I wish was somewhat more independent. Tends to follow the AFL-CIO, but you have workers' centers. You have Moral Monday, where people came together and unions participated. There's a lot of forms. We need to experiment. We need to be flexible. And we just can't sit back and wait for the AFL-CIO Executive Council to lead. And another thing, Jack, in terms of coming from the ground floor up, absolutely. But where did single-payer health care come from? You know, it was blocked. You remember the committee, health care committee, was split evenly in the AFL-CIO, and Sweeney was on the wrong side. So for years it went by. People on the outside had to organize. And kudos to this single-payer healthcare coalition, labor campaign for single payer. They did a super job. They built from the ground floor up. They got union after union on board. And when they came to these conventions, they had resolutions signed by wholesale numbers. And they're now even partially subsidized by the AFL-CIO. That's a movement that, like marriage equality, pretty much swept the country. And now it's a majority movement. And it's been embraced by the labor movement. So I think we have to use these different forms in order to get the job done.
Before you move on to independent politics, hold your thoughts, Jerry. We'll certainly come back to that. But I want to give Chris. Is Chris on yet? Chris Silvera of the Teamsters has had problems getting on here. Chris, are you here? No, I guess he wasn't able to get on somehow. Okay, so you know, maybe we'll have Chris back for another session. What all of you, if I can summarize a little bit up to this point, have been focusing on is on grassroots solutions, both to the organizing, in other words, shop floor organizing, an open shop environment, members-only unions, IDEA, organizing with the community, and so forth, and the grassroots. We know the record is absolutely clear that the national union leadership is not actively, proactively in favor of all this, and sometimes even oppose to this. I'm not one who thinks that the solution is to change national union leadership. I don't think that's going to occur. I think the legal web is so great and so strong and built up over decades that it's almost impossible to reform national union leadership. And that it has to come from below, both in terms of organizing and new bargaining initiatives and new forms of labor community and political action. But I'm yet to hear how this would be structured and organized differently than it has to date, independent of national union leadership. Maybe it's not possible. Maybe national union leadership would thwart and stymie any this new members-only approach that Greg talks about, and this open shop, independent organizing that you know, Steve is talking about, and labor community coalitions that you are talking about, Jerry. But what are your thoughts about how this whole concept of how we're organized at the local level might need to change in order to unleash the solidarity, to unleash the labor community cooperation in a new way, new fundamental way, and so forth. Any thoughts by any of you on that particular topic? I think we're all agreed it's got to come from below, right? But it just can't say it's got to happen. Things happen because you have an organization which permits it to happen, that enables it, that encourages it to happen. And obviously the organization we have now at the local union level is very isolated. We stay within the confines of the company, within the confines of the contract, etc. Once in a while we break out with a little strike, maybe here and there, but that's not even happening anymore much. What are your thoughts about that? Unions, the union movement has always resurrected itself, but in that resurrection, going back to the 19th century, 20th century, so forth, has always been new organizational forms that enable this rank-and-file upsurge. Any thoughts?
You know, I think a good example of this, a concrete example, is the community Postal Workers United. You know, every gain that the postal workers ever got was gained by an illegal strike. But then once they achieved that, the union transferred the strike fund into a political action fund. And then Congress, you know, eventually sabotaged the Postal Service by demanding that they fund retirement 75 years in advance. You know, no mm-hmm. private company would ever be able to carry a burden like that. And then the union responds by bargaining for two-tier and trying to help, you know, save money and cut jobs and so forth. Now, out of this came this community of Postal Workers United, and it's retired postal workers, it's community people, and it's active workers. And rather than reinforcing this pattern of learned helplessness by voting for some new collaborators, their toolbox is based on what Jamie Partridge calls the four C's: combativeness, confidence, and class consciousness. Now, they started, they had a hunger strike back in 2012, in which they were publicizing that Congress is starving the post office. And this was really the first time that the public became aware that the post office problems were actually a result of an act of Congress. They occupied post offices, mail processing centers. They camped out in Washington, D.C. They interrupted a lame duck session of Congress. In this lame duck session, they wanted to stop Saturday delivery. They blocked a scab trucking outfit. And, you know, they were arrested, and they were going to be prosecuted for interfering with the U.S. mail, except because they had workers on the inside informing these retired postal workers on the outside of a sweetheart deal in which some of these trucks that were leaving were actually empty. So the post office was paying the scab trucking company to move empty trucks. So in this action, and again, this is coordinated by inside workers and outside community activists, they reveal the sweetheart deals that are going on. I think this is an example of grassroots community activists working, you know, and this is solidarity unionism, and this is political action, but it's tied into bargaining, and it's tied into organizing.
How do you extend and continue that after the immediate fight is over, in anticipation and preparation for other fights that will obviously come?
I think that we need victories. In other words, the best organizing strategy is to fight the boss and win, not kiss the boss's butt and grin. So when you have actions like this, it encourages other people to say, see what they did. That you know, we have to have these smaller victories, and this isn't over. This is an ongoing thing. I think we all need, and the union needs to get behind these community of postal workers united, and encourage and aid these people to spread that fight.
Let's move on to the question of political strategy. I know, Jerry, you have some very definite views on this, so I'm going to let you take 3-5 minutes to shoot on this, go forward, and then I, you know, give both Steve and Greg a opportunity to add their 2 cents on what needs to change in the union's political strategies, both local and national, you might say. And, you know, by now it should be clear to listeners that all these three strategies are linked to each other, right? The organizing allows bargaining power and political power, and the lack of political power translates into organizing problems, et cetera. You know, it's a interactive, many directions, and as one goes down, it drags the other down of the three strategy areas. But, Jerry, tell us what's wrong with putting out almost $1 billion in two national elections here and virtually nothing except a few maybe token NLRB appointments to show for it for organized labor so far.
Well, as we all know, labor, with a few exceptions, is chained to the Democratic Party. It's a junior partner, which does the legwork, makes the phone calls, knocks on the doors. Politicians play up to it before the election. Then after it's over, they're out to lunch. They have no time for us. So the country's ruled by two corporate parties. And how has this worked for us? Take the 2008 election. Result was a Democratic president, control of the Senate by the Democrats, 59-41, control of the House by the Democrats, 257-178. And as you pointed out, what did labor get out of it? Nothing, really, none of our priorities. No job program, no labor law reform, no repeal of right to work or Taft-Hartley, no restoration of the right to strike, no Employees Free Choice Act. All the basics of the program and ignored. And yet you continue to hear people in the labor movement talk about the Democratic Party as a workers' party and our party. It's ridiculous. Now, in about 5 months, Chicago's going to be holding its mayoral primary. And if there's no majority, there'll be a runoff. And hope that many of us have is that Karen Lewis, the president of the teachers union, will run as an independent. And she was asked, can Rahm Emanuel be beaten? And she said, characteristic of Karen, she says, he can be beaten by Bozo the Clown. But whatever Seaside in Chicago, there is a critical need for labor to more aggressively participate in a political arena in an independent capacity and lay the basis for a workers' party based on the unions and progressive community groups. And one of the brightest developments, most favorable recent developments, is Mark Dimenstein's election as president of the American Postal Workers Union, because Mark is a longtime, very strong advocate of a labor party, an independent political action. And our hope is, he's just new in office, but that he will help in this resurrection of the labor party movement, and we'll move forward to establish a party that is run by, for, and of workers.
Anyone else want to comment on that?
I would second what Jerry said. I think if Karen Lewis, the head of the Chicago Teachers, ran as a labor-backed candidate against Manuel, it would be great. It would be a very high-profile example of what we need a lot more of. I mean, I think we have to be ecumenical about how we get to the goal that Jerry described as a workers' party. Clearly, the local level attempts by individual labor activists or labor-backed independent campaigns around the country have been waged recently under a wide variety of labels. You had an open socialist and a party-affiliated candidate, Shama Sawant, get elected to the city council in Seattle. She's a union member, a union activist. Elsewhere, people have campaigned under other banners. In Vermont, you have some great labor activists running for office and getting elected as candidates of the Vermont Progressive Party. New Haven, Connecticut, AFSCME and the hotel workers have sponsored a group called New Haven Rising, which now controls most of the city council in that city. In Lorain, Ohio, and Jerry State, you had some labor dissidents take on incumbent Democrats and knock them out of the box in recent city council elections. Down south in Jackson, Mississippi, there's an independent politics movement. Here in Richmond, California, where I live, we have a group called the Richmond Progressive Association, Progressive Alliance. Howie Hawkins, a UPS worker running for governor of New York, is a Green. I think hopefully at some point these disparate efforts will add up to more of a coordinated national effort to promote greater labor independence from the Democratic Party at other levels of government.
Well, Steve, is the time ripe then with these very local-level independent initiatives with some successes breaking out all around the country? Is the time right, or is it premature that maybe these people have broken out to call a national convention of their similar efforts elsewhere? And, those local unions who are willing to work with them and community groups come together in some sort of national convention and say, okay, how do we generalize this in some sort of a broader movement and publicize it better and actively try to expand from our local union, staying at the local level efforts? I mean, is it premature for something like that?
Well,
or obviously at some point it's got to come together, or all you're going to have is these little whack-a-mole risings political here and there.
Well, I think Jerry would be expert on that because he was very heavily involved in working with the great late Tony Mazzocchi and trying to build a U.S. Labor Party in the 1980s and 90s. There's some experience there to draw upon. I think given the diversity of these efforts and the local focus, it'd be a little hard to will something into being at the national level at this point. But certainly if someone like Karen Lewis, the leader of a major public sector union, takes on a big city mayor, there's a lot more attention going to be paid to union members running for office and not doing it as Democrats, which, of course, is the AFL-CIO's preferred approach to labor involvement.
Jerry, I'm going to give you the last one minute reply to that that same question that I pose. Is it time or premature? Does it have to take the form of a labor party? As long as it's independent political action, it doesn't necessarily have to be a labor party, does it? But is it time for a national convention or in the near future for these winners, these independent political winners to themselves get together and say, well, let's see how we can unite here and spread the political independent direction? 1 minute, Jerry, and then we got to...
Okay, well, I think what's needed right now is more transitional steps, having some consultation with people like Mark Dimenstein, hopefully Karen Lewis, maybe launching something like a new version of Labor Party Advocates, which Tony led in preparation for the Labor Party convention. So I think that it's a process. It's going to take more time. And I think as a result of an accumulation of experiences, which Steve outlined, that we can gauge where it's at and take it step by step. So hopefully more unions will join. Hopefully the American Postal Workers Union will give leadership and other unions will join. I remember during the Vietnam War, the AFL-CIO Executive Board was unanimous all the way to the end in supporting the war, except for one union, AFSCME, Jerry Wirth, the lone dissenter. We need some dissenters. We need a John L. Lewis. We need somebody that's going to break and go in a different direction, and they'll only do it when there's enough pressure from below. And the single-payer labor campaign for single-payer, to me, is a classic example of how you can build from below and win agreement at the top, willy-nilly.
Okay, I want to thank you all for your excellent contributions here. We can go on for a long time, I'm sure. We just scratched the surface on this topic of labor at impasse, political bargaining, and organizing membership, and I thank you all for your input. Yours truly will be responding with some of my own very, very shortly, but I wanted to give everyone else a chance to talk, and there's obviously a hope at the end of the tunnel here, you might say, on all levels from what you've been talking about, both in bargaining and organizing and politics here. And maybe that's the message for this Labor Day. As bleak as it seems, there are bright lights beginning to appear, and those lights are local. I'm not one believing that national political leaders or union leaders are going to save us. In fact, they'll do everything they can, kicking and screaming, to oppose it. But the solution's got to come from below. It's got to come from the local level. We need some courageous local union leaders and activists at all levels, local and community, to take this bull by the horns and to lead again and resurrect labor, as has happened in our history numerous times. Okay, I want to thank you all. And maybe in a future show, we'll have some of the other people we've interviewed on to talk about the same topic. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions on.